Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Do you ever sit in the pews on a Sunday morning, staring at the pastor and ask yourself, I wonder where he got his training? I wonder what that training was like. How much of his seminary education is coming through in his sermon now? Has seminary education been changing over time to keep up with current educational trends? Is seminary a place where you wear hooded robes, ring church bells, keep a vow of silence, and eat porridge and rye bread at a long wooden table in a cold dining hall with 50 of your brethren? You know, like those monks used to do back in the Middle Ages? Or is it somehow different in our contemporary era with the internet and all? Well, as an educator myself, I've often wondered what seminary education is all about. What practical use might it have for clergy, and how one might go about establishing an institution of theological learning? And more specifically, I've become increasingly interested in the realm of online education, as I teach an online course myself, and how that may be affecting the way we train our pastors and theologians in this modern era. To help me fulfill my queries, I've invited Dr. Rick Walston, founder and president of Columbia Evangelical Seminary, located physically in Longview, Washington, but which has a geographic reach on the internet that goes much beyond that. I chose Rick to be a guest on the show because he has had the experience of dreaming up, creating, and administering a theological seminary, and thus has a unique perspective on the various challenges of seminary education. He holds various degrees, including a Ph.D. from Northwest University in South Africa, and master's degrees from Luther Rice University and Warner Pacific College. And he is also the author of numerous books, including Seeking to Divorce Proof Your Marriage, Walston's Guide to Christian Distance Learning, Something Happened on the Way to Happily Ever After, A Biblical View of Marriage, Divorce, and Remarriage, and The Speaking in Tongues Controversy, to name just his most recent scholarship. As always, you can find links to these books, the Columbia Evangelical Seminary website, and other interesting tidbits on our website, so please pay us a visit. Hey, Rick, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks, Tony. It's a privilege to be with you today.
So I have to ask, are you one of those monastic types that wears the burlap robes and eats cabbage soup like in the old medieval monastery days?
Well, you know, as nice as that sounds, I'm more of a jeans and t-shirt or jeans and casual shirt kind of guy, and while cabbage soup sounds good, I think I'd go with the pizza.
Okay, pizza's good too. Well, you the jeans and t-shirt kind of fits with the whole Pacific Northwest way of doing things. I also know from your own Facebook page that you're an avid hiker, so you love being out there in the outdoors. Do you have any specific hikes that are your favorites?
Well, I have one specific one that's my favorite simply because I do it all the time. It's only a couple miles from my office, and it's called Mount Peak. And it's a short hike. It's only a 1.1 mile to the top. It's a 1,000-foot ascent. So when I tell people that it's a 1.1 mile hike, and of course then you have to come down, so it's 2.2, but they all kind of chuckle thinking, well, that's nothing. But it's a 1,000-foot ascent, so it becomes pretty arduous.
Yeah, no, that's like walking upstairs for a mile. All right. So, hey, we know that you're a hiker. We know that you're living in Longview, Washington. But
actually, no. My wife and I live in Buckley, Washington.
Buckley, Washington.
Right.
But I think, you know, we get listeners from Australia and stuff. They're probably not going to know where that
right,
is.
Right.
It's pretty close. So is Buckley pretty close to Longview, Washington?
Actually, we're closer to Seattle. We're
really?
About 30 miles east of Tacoma.
Oh. See, I didn't know that.
Right.
I have to learn that kind of stuff. So I am learning more about you. How about learning about a little bit about your background? You're running a seminary now. Did you grow up with a religious upbringing?
Actually, no. My family, they weren't anti-Christian. We didn't go to church. We were, I guess, just a secular family, and we did have a minister in our family, my dad's brother. But pretty much when he came over, everybody hid because nobody wanted to hear him talk about, you know, we're all going to die and go to hell. So No, I grew up in a typical non-Christian home. I had two brothers and three sisters, and two of my brothers were killed in a car wreck in 1959. I was 5 years old at the time. But as I grew up, religion just wasn't a part of our lifestyle.
Did you grow up here in the Pacific Northwest or somewhere else?
Actually, I grew up in Longview, Washington.
Okay. And that's a pretty unchurched area of the country.
Well, I hear that, here in this Pacific Northwest area, that we're kind of rather unchurched.
So tell us a little bit about your educational background. I want to find out. We're in this unchurched area, supposedly unchurched area, and might be becoming more church. We'll figure that out. But how do you go from living in a, I'd say, religiously apathetic home to becoming somebody who runs a seminary? Where did you get your schooling training, and where did you start becoming interested in theology?
Well, from apathy to conversion, I had what I call a cataclysmic experience with Christ, and I came to believe in Christ and accept Christ in 1975, and it was so dramatic the lifestyle change in my life that my father actually wanted me to see a psychiatrist. He thought I'd gone nuts, and I was quite willing to do that if he wanted to set that up, because I just figured that would give me somebody else to preach to, and witness to. But I did have that experience. But one of the things for me was that growing up, I absolutely hated school. I hated being in class. I hated public school. I would sit while all the other kids were studying, and I would stare out the window wishing I were outside riding my bicycle, anything, but rather than being in class. So I became a Christian in 75, and probably only a year later, I felt the drawing from the Lord to be in ministry. And I thought, that is the last thing I want to do, because I have to study. You'd have to actually read books.
Mm-hmm.
And but what happened then is slowly God began to draw me into that, and I started by just taking a few correspondence courses with the Assemblies of God program, and started moving in further and further, and then went to college. And you already mentioned that I have a couple master's degrees and also two doctoral degrees. But it was an interesting thing for me, Rick Walston, the kid from Longview who hated school, to end up becoming, and not a Christian, to become a Christian and then do all that education. And I kind of felt like when I was in college that I needed to make up for those 12 years of public school, since I really didn't do much there.
Yeah, you mentioned that you did correspondence courses with the Assembly of God. Now, that's back in the mid-1970s, I would assume?
Yes.
How did that work back then? Because we think about online education now, but back then, communications wasn't all that easy.
Exactly. It was basically just by mail. Of course, you'd, send a letter and, of course, get in touch with them, and they would send out the application form, fill it out, mail it back. They would mail you the information. Then you would select the courses that you want. You'd send them the money. Then they would send you the courses and the books that go with it, and then you'd fill out the information. Then you'd send it back to them. So it was just mail correspondence, basically.
And we're going to cover this a little bit later, but since we're at this point of your life, too, and since you mentioned that you weren't big into school when you were grade school and junior high and high school, how was it taking correspondence courses? Was that a little bit different? Did you enjoy that more because you had a little bit more control, that you can do it on your own time instead of sitting in there?
Well, actually, yes. I mean, it was a big difference, but it wasn't for those reasons. It was because I was finally interested in the topic.
Mm-hmm.
Being a Christian, I was horrified first thing to find out that the Christianity was the religion of a book, and I had to read that.
Mm-hmm.
But once I started reading the Bible, and my reading was very poor. In fact, as I recall, this is a bad confession to make from a seminary president, but as I recall, I don't remember reading an entire book through my entire public school system. And when I needed to do like a book report, I would simply give it to my girlfriend, the book, to my girlfriend, who would then read the book, write the report, and sometimes I would literally hand it in a girlfriend's writing. And one time, one of my teachers in high school said, "Rick, this is an A paper, but I know you didn't write it, so I'm going to give you a C," which was fine with me. So I got the C. So I wasn't interested. But once I became a Christian, I couldn't get enough about Jesus and the history of Christianity and all of that, and how all that developed in the theology. Really was a big turn-on for me. And so when I started doing the correspondence study, I just started devouring it simply because it was a topic that was of terrific interest for me.
Can I ask you a little bit about that cataclysmic experience? What brought you to Christ?
Yeah, the do you have a specific question or just want me to go from here?
I guess just kind of the story of what that experience is. Was it, another auto accident? Was it, hitting rock bottom or what?
No, nothing like that. What happened was, actually, I was out over at a friend's house, and we were partying. We were doing the drinking and all the stuff that kids do, 19, 20 years old. And he says, "Hey, Rick, I've got this book you've got to read." And I said, "I don't read books." And he said, "No, seriously, you've got to read this book." And I said, "No, seriously, I don't read books." And he goes, "Okay, well, just take a look at this one." So he went off to his bedroom, he came back with this book, and he handed it to me. And it was a book about a fellow who had gone through a very satanic culture and how he had come out of that. And I said, "Why would I want to read this?" And he said, "Well, it's about sex, drugs, and all of a sudden now my interest has peaked because that's what we were all into at that time."
Yeah.
And so I dragged the book home, and I started reading it and struggling through it because, as I said, I wasn't a very good reader. And at the same time, I worked for my father. He owned an auto body shop. And in the shop where I worked with him, there was a fellow who was a deacon at a local Assemblies of God church. And so as I would read this book about satanic stuff, I would ask this guy questions. Well, then about the same time, my preacher uncle was out of a church, and my dad said, "Well, come to work for us during this period." So now I have a deacon I'm working next to, and a Baptist pastor I'm working next to, and so I would be bouncing these questions off of each of them. And so this book, which would normally take a normal person 2 or 3 days to read, took me a period of about 8 months because I read it slowly and I took my time and then I partied in between chapters and various things. And ultimately, I came to a point where I began to realize, if this is all true, if this, what this guy's writing about is true, and if there's this satanic culture, then there must be a God. And so on top of the reading, I went to the deacon there, and I said, "Hey, I want to come to your church on Sunday and just check it out." So I did. I thought that was interesting, a little scary, but interesting. And then I went to my uncle's church, and I thought that was a little odd. I didn't particularly care for it. But my point was is that I started going to church on rare occasions, continued to read the book, and over at about an eight-month period of time, as I said, I finally came to the conclusion of the book and to the conclusion that God might exist. And so I simply said an odd prayer that most people think is odd. It was where I was at the time. And I said to the Lord, "I'll make you a deal. I will become a Christian and do what Christians are supposed to do and accept Christ in my heart. If you exist within a year, show me that. If you don't, then I'll know that today I'm just speaking to four walls." And so I made that commitment, started going to church, I started reading the Bible, and here I am some 30-odd years later.
Hmm. So what about when you started going to church? Were there specific denominations that you went to? You mentioned there was a deacon from, was it Assemblies of God?
Assemblies of God.
And then your uncle was Baptist.
Yes, he was Reformed Baptist.
Okay.
And so, I actually started going to the Reformed Baptist Church and because of, he was there and I knew him, obviously. And so I would go there and, we went through the water baptism and all that stuff and started learning there. But the problem with the church that he was pastoring, so he was pastoring part-time at this small church, and the church was a collective of little ladies and children. Mm-hmm. And I didn't fit in. I was 20 years old, and there was nobody there my own age. But
yeah, the churches are not places you go looking for young single men.
True.
Yeah.
But at the Assemblies of God Church, which was quite a bit larger, there were quite a few people my own age, and the deacon that I mentioned, he actually taught a class called College Career Class. And the College Career Class were for people my age, 20 years old, and give or take a few years back and forth. And so I asked him if I could come to his Sunday school class, and he said, "Sure, of course." So I did, and then I started meeting people my own age and started hanging out with them. So while I had already now developed a Reformed Baptist theology, I started going to the Assemblies of God for the fellowship. And so it was kind of an interesting mix.
And so during that first year that you made that deal, What convinced you? Was there any big blinding light that came down, or was it just a slow progression of maybe there's something to this?
I think it was the slow progression. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any blinding light. There was no cataclysmic. When I said cataclysmic earlier, I simply meant that my life had changed so drastically. Not that I had some knocked off the horse experience, but yeah, it was continuing to read the Bible, continuing to go to church, continuing to hear the preaching. I became more and more convinced that there was indeed a God, and that he was, in fact, active in the affairs of men.
So you start taking correspondence courses, mm-hmm. and learning more about this, and what happens between that point, so we're talking mid to maybe late 1970s, and right around the time of the early 90s that you set up Columbia Evangelical Seminary. So there's about a decade and a half. What were you doing then? Were you going to college, working extra jobs? Were you still affiliating yourself with the Assemblies of God? What's going on in your life then?
Well, there's a lot of questions there. You pretty much answered it, though. I did just continue on to more school. I went to college in Texas for a while, and then I transferred to Warner Pacific College in Portland, Oregon. And I was doing odd jobs here and there, doing what I could do to, pay for my schooling. At Warner Pacific, I actually worked for as an administrative assistant to the registrar. So that was interesting because I began to see how schools function. Rather than just being a student, I was a student and administrator at the same time. And all of a sudden, all those kinds of doors started opening up to me. And I thought, well, this is all very interesting. Kind of behind the scenes, what do you do to run a school? How do you, accept incoming transfer students? In fact, that was my primary job for the registrar, was that when incoming transfer students, applied, I was the one who looked at their application and accepted them or rejected them or determined which credits would be accepted, which ones would not, all, of course, by the policies of the school, set by the policies of the school. But, and I continued on for school, and then I also pastored. After my bachelor's degree, I pastored for a few years, and during the time that I was working on my bachelor's degree, I was an associate pastor. So I would drive from Portland, where I was going to school, to Longview, where I was as an associate pastor, which was about a 60-mile trip. So I would drive back and forth, and so I worked as an associate pastor for a while. And then after I graduated, the senior pastor resigned and went on to a different location, and I was voted in as the senior pastor. And at this time, this was now an Assemblies of God church. And so I pastored that church for a few years and then went back to school for my master's degree. And so basically, I continued on with my education, working and going to school all at the same time.
So one of the reasons I wanted to have you specifically as a guest is that you had the experience of creating a seminary, and not just slipping into the faculty or administration of a pre-existing one, like a Fuller or something that's been around for a very long period of time. We get to see what happens at the beginning from its inception. And that fascinates me because I'm somebody who always likes to know about the nuts and bolts of these kind of things, what's going on in the mind of an entrepreneur such as yourself, somebody who takes a risk on an idea or a dream they have. And so you're pastoring as a senior pastor at Assemblies of God Church. Where did this idea of setting up a seminary, specifically Columbia Evangelical Seminary, come from?
Well, I always felt like, which is, again, seems contradictory, that I always felt like God wanted me to start something educationally. And I say it's contradictory because in public school system, I hated education.
Yeah.
So I felt like that, but I didn't know, how in the world am I going to do that unless the Lord drops millions of dollars in my lap where I can build a campus and have a cafeteria and a sports field and all that. How's that ever going to happen? So I just pretty much just put that on the back burner of my mind. But when I was doing my, I was a senior pastor at the Assemblies of God Church, and then I resigned there to go back to school. And when I went back to school for my first graduate degree, my master's degree, it was during that time, and working with the registrar as the administrative assistant, we started getting students trying to transfer in with the transcripts from schools that we'd never heard of. And we had this blue book, literally, it was a big blue book, and we'd say, look in the blue book, and we'd look in the book, and it was supposed to be a list of all the schools throughout the U.S., and other parts of the world, for that matter, and they weren't. These schools weren't in the books. So she, the registrar, charged me with the job of finding out about these schools. So I started doing some background research into what's available through education in distance, because I could tell from the materials coming in that these were distance schools. And back then, they didn't call it distance learning; they called it non-traditional education.
Or correspondence schools. That's what you did in the 70s, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, in the process of trying to find things out, I ran across a book by a fellow named John Baer. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with who Dr. John Baer is, but John is the kind of the granddaddy of distance learning in the United States as far as who knows what. He worked for the FBI on occasion, helping them bust diploma mills. He was on shows like 60 Minutes, 2020, helping them, understand the whole process and what the FBI had done. He appeared in federal court as an expert witness on education, distance learning, and diploma mills. Well, I found his book. And so he had a list of schools, and basically what he did in his book is he listed various schools that he was aware of that were distance learning schools, correspondence schools, that were bad and that were good. And he would make the clarification, so if somebody wanted to do something by distance learning or non-traditional education or correspondence, they could look at his book, and he had already done the homework for them in saying, okay, this is a bad school, this is what you want to stay away from, and here's why, here's a good one, and here's why. And so that book, I started seeing some of the schools that students were trying to transfer into our school were listed in that book. And so I was able to take that book back to the registrar and say, okay, here's what we've got. And then from there, there was a chapter in John's book on religious schools. And in the introduction to that chapter, he said, look, I'm not a Christian. I don't pretend to be. So if I've misunderstood the theology of these schools or whatever, please give me a break. And, you know, give me the benefit of the doubt. I'm not trying to be rude. I'm just trying to classify them. So I wrote him a letter. And, again, not email. Back then it was letters. This is about 1986, I guess. And I said, hey, I'm finishing up my master's degree in the field that you, you know, say you don't know much about. I would love to jump in with you and maybe be a consultant for you on this chapter. Well, long story short, I ended up going to California to meet with him. And that's where he lived, in Berkeley. And we ended up doing a full book rather than just consulting on the chapter. And the first book that came out was Walston and Bear's Guide to Non-Traditional Christian Learning, I believe it was. That was the title. And that's how we moved to that part. And I started getting interested in distance learning. Now, your question, basically, if I recall, since I've been rattling on for so long, was how do we get to from there to the school?
Right.
And so the thing was that I found was the Christian schools that were doing correspondence programs, they simply were either, not all of them, but the ones that I found, I'm sure them. I should have said not all of them, in that there might be some out there at that time that were doing it well, but typically they lied about accreditation.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, their faculty had their degrees from their own school or another equally bad school. Typically, what they required for a degree was substandard to what was traditional. And so in looking at these schools, and also all of this is interwoven, going back to the fact that I was the person that was taking the incoming transfer students, I had to reject these students because I started finding out what these schools were about. And so what I began to realize is that this might be the avenue to start that school that I felt God had told me to so many years ago without needing millions of dollars for a campus. We could do the same correspondence method that they're doing, but do it by the book in that we're not lying about accreditation. We're not having faculty all from our own school. And that we offer them a program that's comparable in requirements as to a traditional setting. And that's when the process began to put together Columbia Seminary.
Now, I have to stop here, too, because I remember growing up in the 1970s, and when you would hear correspondence school and religious seminary, usually that meant you got something out of the back of your Spider-Man comic book
exactly,
that ordained you as a minister so that you could go to Las Vegas and marry your best friends or something
exactly.
Like that. That's the image that it had. Was that a lot of what you were finding? Or
absolutely.
Okay.
And you're exactly right. That was the thing back then. It was, I mean, the attitude toward correspondence schools was that, and predominantly it was correct. That was a correct response to all that, and that's kind of what we were finding. Now, what was sad, of course, is that a lot of these are claiming to be Christian organizations, and yet they were misleading people about accreditation. They were telling people, you know, if you get a degree from our school, you can go on to Fuller or Harvard or wherever you want. I mean, they would tell them anything to make people come in and buy their program. It was really sad.
Now, what's also interesting here, too, is that prior to this, you had been taking correspondence courses from Assemblies of God. Did you have this, looking at both of your experiences there, this blue book with these courses, and then Bear's book of looking into some of these, and then thinking back about your own correspondence school, did you think about the relationship there?
The relationship was only in that I recognized that the Assemblies of God while they were not offering degrees, by the way, they were simply offering you certificates. Number one, there was no lies about accreditation, and it was pretty much an in-house sort of thing. You study with these programs, these correspondence courses, this will lead you to a position where you can apply to be a minister in the Assemblies of God. So it was all very in-house.
Okay.
Whereas these other schools were making these fantastic claims that you get a degree from them, and it would open doors in all sorts of worlds.
Yeah. Okay, so you're investigating that, and on your website, you give a story, and it starts out somewhat dramatically, that you're sitting on a beach in California or at a beach house in California.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that moment, that eureka or aha or I'm going to do this moment.
Well, that was it was more the I'm going to finally put this together moment, because prior to this time, that was in 1989, prior to that time, as I said, in 1986, I was already working at that school.
Right.
And started getting introduced to John Bearer's book and started communicating with him and started investigating these schools. And so over that period of time from 86 to 89, I had been doing this research and investigation of all these various schools and had made my way to California to talk with John. And we together began working on the book. And so it was at this point where I realized, you know, I think that it's all coming together. Now, my wife and I were on a vacation. We were in California at Moss Beach. And we were at her sister's house, and everybody, you know, thankfully for me, everybody decided they were going to go out and go shopping or whatever, and I got to stay at the house alone, and their back deck overlooked the ocean. And so I'm just sitting there, enjoying the sunshine, sitting on the deck, looking at the ocean, and there was a local small airport that was putting on an aerial show, so I was sitting there watching these, you know, biplanes do loop-de-loops and all this sort of thing. And it was during that time, just sitting there and praying and talking to the Lord and looking at all this wonder, that I began to think, you know, maybe it's time to put something together. So I went back in the house and got some paper and a pencil or two and sat down and started scratching out, okay, if we do this right, what would it look like? And then I started figuring out, you know, and started writing down, if we, you know, what would the correspondence look like? How many credits would it take for each program and so on and so forth? And that's when I began putting down the basis of what then became the school.
So you mentioned that you were married at that time, and you're now sitting on the veranda watching an air show in the ocean, scratching out ideas for a seminary. Did your wife come back from shopping and you all of a sudden said, "Hi, honey, guess what? I'm starting a seminary." And did she think you were crazy for that?
Well, this is 1989, so I don't remember the exact dialogue.
Yeah.
But I think the short answer is no, actually. My wife was terribly supportive. She felt that if I had something that I felt that the Lord was calling me to do, that I should jump into it with both feet. And so she really was behind me 100% from the beginning.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That's very helpful. If I told my wife, "Hi, you know, I'm creating my own school here," I think she would. I would be sleeping on the couch a lot. So,
well, but then she knew that of my time, you know, speaking with John Bearer and being together with him. In fact, she was with me when we met.
Yeah.
So she knew. She came along with me during this journey.
Okay.
Of looking back and taking each step as we went. So it didn't really come as a shock to her.
So, let me ask this question. I mean, there are a lot of seminaries out there. There's the Fuller Seminary and this and that seminary and such. Was there a question right there that said, you know, when you're thinking of this, when you're scratching this out, did you have to ask yourself, why do we need another seminary?
Actually, I didn't ask that question. I knew others would ask that question.
Aha.
And the answer was simple. We're not doing another seminary. We're doing a distance learning program that other good seminaries are not doing. Only the bad ones are. And what we needed was the tertian quid there, the in-between one. We needed the one that's doing it by correspondence, but at the same time doing it legitimately without the lies of accreditation and so on and so forth, and be transparent. So we weren't really another one. We were a one in a small group, well, small now. I mean, it's much larger now, but there were still quite a few schools then. But we were actually one in a small group that would take things in a very much different direction than the other ones had done, mm-hmm. in that we would try to be honest about everything that we're doing, what we could and could not offer, have solid faculty, and say bluntly and upfront, we're not accredited.
Yeah, I want to get to that accreditation issue later because it's a very important one, and you make a very interesting argument or have a discussion about that on your website. But again, taking you back to this moment, was there this instance where you start thinking about I'm thinking of the baseball movie Field of Dreams, where you know somebody gets a calling to build a baseball field in the middle of a cornfield, and Kevin Costner says, "Well, I got to do this, but this is why am I doing this? I'm destroying a couple acres of crops here. You know, nobody's going to come to do this." Did you have that moment where you stopped and said, "Okay, if we set this up, is anybody really going to come and sign up with us?" How did you go through that thought process?
Well, we certainly had that thought process, and we didn't really have the idea of if we build it, they will come. We just knew that there was a vacuum, and I felt this was perhaps the way by which the feeling that I had years earlier to build a school, to put something together academically, could be fulfilled. So my perspective really wasn't so much on, what kind of student body would we grow into, what would happen with it, as much as it was that first initial step of saying, "Yes, Lord, I'll step out and start doing this." So I didn't have the "we'll build it and they will come" mentality, and of course I did wonder who's going to come.
Mm-hmm.
Would anybody come? Now, understanding that I had already seen other schools, distance learning schools, doing what I consider poor jobs of it, having a fairly good student body, I thought, well, others are doing it, so why not us?
Okay. So I want to now, again, dive into the nuts and bolts here, and this is going to move us to the accreditation issue, but it's just the logistics of this. Now, again, this is a distance learning slash correspondence, and you know, we're at the very initial stages of the internet, so eventually becomes online learning. So you have, in that respect, it is pretty low startup cost. You don't have to build a campus. You don't have to get the sports team and the swimming pool and all that kind of stuff. You noted in the history of, on your website, the Columbia Evangelical Seminary, that you wanted to do everything by the book.
Right.
And, here in the state of Washington, we have lots of regulations about everything. So you wanted to fill out all the right paperwork. What was that process like? Did you have to drive over to Olympia and say, "Hi, I'm starting a school. Where's the paperwork?" And was it an easy process? Was it difficult?
Well, actually, it was difficult. And it was an interesting process in that we were kind of the guinea pig of the changes of Washington State that was going on at the time. Prior to us starting the school, what happened was, if there was, and there were a few schools like what we were doing, correspondence, non-accredited correspondence Christian schools, operating in Washington State at the time. So prior to ours, what would happen is all you'd have to do is hand them in a catalog that you're going to put together. Here's our seminary catalog or college catalog, whatever. And I think it was like a $50 fee, and they would simply register it what's the word I want? Isn't that funny? It just slips out of my mind. It's a non-recognized program. It's a religious exempt school.
Okay.
So it's religious exempt in that it's exempt from state oversight. And so as long as you pay your state fee and you have your catalog showing that you're a religious school, they just basically rubber stamp it as a religious exempt school, and there you go. Well, when we handed in our first rough draft catalog and said, "This is what we're doing," and going, we went through the paperwork with the IRS and the state of Washington and all that stuff, and then of course we have to do the licensing through the Post-Secondary Education Association, and that's where it started getting tough. And they they were at that point recognizing themselves that there was a problem with diploma mills and these schools that were substandard, and so they started saying, "Okay, well, this is what we're going to start requiring of schools." And so it was at that time that we submitted our first catalog, and they said, "Oh." Basically, I don't know the exact terminology because I wasn't sitting at their desks, but I can only imagine they said, "Oh, great, here we have a guinea pig, let's work with this one."
Mm-hmm.
And so then they started going through our program and saying, "Okay, you have to do this." And one of the things we couldn't do, they determined at that point, was that we couldn't offer what they called academic nomenclature. So we couldn't have a BA or an MA or an MS or a PhD. We could have an MREL, Master of Religion, or Master of Biblical Studies, but we couldn't have the Master of Arts title. We couldn't have the PhD, but we could have a Doctor of Christian Philosophy or a Doctor of Theology, Doctor of Ministry. So they limited us as far as those terms, because it would have been nice to have been able to have an MA.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just say MA, and then you could have any major under that MA. But rather than doing that now, every degree title had to be basically its own major. So if you wanted Biblical Studies, you did a Master of Biblical Studies degree. If you wanted to do Counseling, you did a Master of Christian Counseling degree, and so on. And so we had a lot more degree titles than we wanted, simply because that's what the state then required. And then we would, you know, fix the catalog as they wanted, send it back, and then they would say, you know, they'd go through it, and they'd say, okay, here's another thing that we're going to start doing, so you need to change this, and so on and so forth. And so it was about a two-year process, I guess, that the whole thing, well, not quite, but it was quite a process, before they finally gave it their stamp of approval.
The other issue that comes up, so there's all the state regulation and stuff, and something that's related to that is the process of accreditation. And you've mentioned that before when you were working with Bayer, and you saw a lot of these schools that were lying about their accreditation. Accreditation is oftentimes very important for educational institutions because it's a third-party stamp of approval saying, okay, we looked at what they're doing, and this is all proper. You know, the University of Washington has to go through this every several years, and other institutions do. What is your take on accreditation, and is the Columbia Evangelical Seminary now accredited?
My take on accreditation is that it's terrific. It's a great thing, and we should have it in America, and I'm glad we do. That's number one. A lot of people think that, well, and then number two, no, we're not accredited. So a lot of people think since we're not accredited, we're anti-accreditation. That's simply not true. What we have chosen to do is that since we have such flexibility in our program, we cannot have accreditation because there are no accreditors out there who know how to accredit a school with the flexibility that we have. So an accreditation association has to have certain, let me back up, a school has to have certain benchmarks that an accrediting association can then judge that school by. And one of the things that we do in our program is we actually allow our students to devise their own curriculum to meet their own specific needs. So two people, excuse me, taking the same exact degree title might be taking two entirely different sets of classes simply because one's on the mission field and wants to fulfill, you know, studies that helps that person with missions. Another person might be pastoring and wants to do classes in various areas that help him or her do the pastoring thing. Well, that just simply cannot function for an accrediting association because there's no way for them to check every different flexible program. They have while we have a good affiliation, like with one accrediting association, and we're what is called affiliate status with them. We're not accredited by them. They recognize our school as being a good school. They've given us the, you know, you can be affiliated with us, and that's the status title, affiliate status. But we can't be accredited. It's not only that we can't be; we haven't even sought to be, because we know the flexibility that we have simply does not fit their mode of needing to check the school and make sure it's functioning as they want it to function. So that the primary reason why we're not accredited is due to the fact of our flexibility.
Yeah, so the flexibility that you're talking about here is that students have a greater say in designing their own courses.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, the fact that our tuition is so very low is a part of that flexibility as well. If we were to become accredited, the tuition would have to go, you know, triple and quadruple or more, simply because we then would have to pay for everything that comes with the whole accreditation process. Early, I don't know where they're at today, but earlier on in the years when we were looking at all these things, part of the accreditation process is that the school had to have X amount of books in a library. Well, X amount of books in the library was hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, who's going to pay for that? The students are, through tuition. So another thing is that there had to be X amount of PhDs on faculty in the location. Well, who's going to pay for that? The students are through tuition. So if you remove those things, the tuition can remain low, and that's part of the flexibility. Because our mission statement basically is that we were to be a viable alternative for those who, for whatever reason, could not afford to go to a traditional college or seminary. And if we were to become accredited, then we would no longer be fulfilling that mission statement. We would just be one of many other schools doing exactly the same thing.
Tell us a little bit about that mission statement, because that is one of the first things that you have to do as well when you're setting up your school, is to think about, okay, what's our big purpose here? What is our mission? What is Columbia Evangelical Seminary's mission, and are you specifically aimed at one set of denominations, maybe Assemblies of God, or are you interdenominational? What's your mission?
Right. Well, the mission statement is, and I'll just say it again, it's to be a viable alternative for those who cannot afford to, for whatever reason, You know, some people can afford it financially, but they don't want to move their families. Other people could move their families, but they can't afford it financially. So for whatever reason, they cannot afford to go to a traditional school. We want to be a viable alternative. And, of course, viability means that we're going to have some aspect of our program that's going to be comparable to a traditional school. One of those things that we're not comparable in is accreditation. But, nonetheless, for some people, it's still viable because they don't need to have their degree from an accredited school. And then the second question is the denominational. No, we're not denominationally tied at all. We're non-denominational, or rather interdenominational. On our faculty, we have a little over 50 faculty members, and if one looks through the faculty list, one of the things that we do, not only list their bio and their degrees and where they're from, is we try to give their theological persuasion. And we have people on our faculty who are Assemblies of God, some who are Reformed Baptist, Presbyterian, and Methodist, Mennonite, I think we have one Mennonite, and so on. So what happens, this is, again, part of the flexibility. When a student then contacts our school and says, look, I'm interested in your school, one of the reasons why is because I get to develop my own program, but I'm a Reformed Baptist. Can I have somebody work with me who is also a Reformed Baptist? Well, yes, we have one of those, or two of those, or five of those on our faculty. So students get to select the person that they're going to work with through their program so that they can, they working with the professor, can devise a program to meet their specific needs for their ministry that they're going to do.
Which is pretty cool, and I can see how students are going to be drawn to this. And that brings me to my next question of, you get this all set up, you have your mission statement, you have all the paperwork done, and you open the doors, or I should say open the virtual doors right, to your seminary. How did you go about attracting students in the first year or two? Because that must be a difficult thing, because you're brand new,
right?
And a lot of people would say, well, I want to go to an educational institution that has a little bit of a pedigree, some background or history to it. Was it difficult in the first year, two, 3 years to find students? How'd you go about finding them?
Well, first thing we did is advertise in Christianity Today and some other magazines, and just put ourselves out there saying that we're, you know, here's who we are and this is what we do. And that then would draw some folks. And you're right, though. I mean, some people would, and of course there was no, we didn't have email at the time, so people would either phone or mail a letter. And a lot of the questions were, who are you? Where are you from? And so we would be going over with them basically what we've gone over today in our discussion. And then, of course, they would have to determine whether or not that was going to be viable for them. And some of the student body that came in was, in fact, distance students, simply because they wanted to do something, but they couldn't as far as affording. And so that was primarily the way that we reached out, was through advertisements and, of course, word of mouth. But primarily it was advertisements in various magazines and so on. And then, of course, in time we began to drop off certain magazines because some of them brought us clientele that we didn't want. And I mean, for instance, and I won't name magazines, but a certain magazine in mind that we advertised in, it seemed like everybody that responded to those ads were people who had already gone through a program with some of the schools that we rejected years earlier when I was working at the other school. And I would recognize, and that was part of the problem for the incoming students or people that wanted to go to our school, is that I was already knowledgeable about a lot of the stuff that was out there. And so people would say, look, I've already got a master's degree from the school. I want to do a doctorate degree. And there was just no way that the person was ready for doing a doctoral program, simply because I knew what they had done for that master's degree was not standard.
Mm-hmm.
So primarily it was just through advertising in magazines.
Tell us about recruiting faculty as well. So you have the students, but you have the faculty. You say about, you know, you have about 50 faculty members now. How did that start out back in the early 90s of finding people? People that you knew, or who'd you get?
Well, interestingly, I did the same thing. We simply put an ad in Christianity Today and basically said quickly who we were and what we were looking for. And what we didn't do, however, and I learned the hard way, is we didn't clarify that we wanted only those with accredited master's and doctorates to respond. So we had probably within after the first ad, we probably had 300 applications come in. It was overwhelming.
Wow.
But of those 300 applications, probably only about five were people that we actually wanted on our faculty. Again, a lot of people with degrees from schools that I was aware of that simply were not good, and we said there's no way in the world that we're going to put them on our faculty. But then we continued to put ads in CT and other magazines stating, you know, that we wanted people with degrees from accredited masters and accredited doctors. And then that began to happen, and we started getting these people, you know, on faculty. And then, of course, they knew somebody else who, you know, by word of mouth, they would say, hey, you know, I have a friend who might be interested. And so that started building up. And it was only probably two or three ads that we did beyond that initial one that we needed to do, and we've never done one since because we filled up fairly quickly with quite a few people. And then from then till now, we've done no advertising. It's just, of course, word of mouth. And, of course, a lot of people will contact us on their own. They'll see us on the website, and they'll say, hey, you know, this is my background. In fact, I was looking at an application that came in, not an application, but a query that came in today. Sadly, we won't be able to go forward with the fellow because he has a degree from one of those schools that I'm quite aware of that mm-hmm. we simply don't want on our faculty.
So how have you grown over the year? How many students did you start off with, and where are you about now? And I know this is somewhat of a difficult question because you do have a different dynamic to yourself. You don't have a necessarily incoming class that has freshman orientation, but, you know, it might be a kind of flow through the pipeline. But how many students do you serve a year?
I'm not sure a year because I don't really deal with the numbers, and I don't care. I deal with the students, and as they come in, we deal with them. As they grow out, you know, graduate, we you know, bless them and say, you know, good for you. So I don't have a number on the per year, but right now we presently have, I thought this question would come up, so I checked. We presently have 84 students now, mm-hmm. And we've always stayed under the 100 student mark, whereas some schools, what I call colleges, which is a school that is doing things substandardly, some of those will have thousands of students presently at any given time. What we found, of course, is that as we would have students apply and then they found out, oh, this is what I'm required to do, they would either not enroll, or we'd have students enroll expecting to have an easy degree program and then find out, oh, my goodness, I've got to do all this work like a regular seminary, mm-hmm. and so then they would drop out. So we've always been quite small because we have people who are quite serious about getting degrees that were comparable in educational requirements to traditional seminaries. And so we've always had a smaller number of people. Now, over the years, we've become fairly well-known, so a lot of people simply don't apply. We've had letters, I've had personal emails from lots of folks who say, you know, I've always wanted to do a degree with your program, but I'm frightened, frankly, because I think it's going to be too difficult. So I think we've maybe, you know, in trying to be solidly academically astute, have actually scared off quite a few students.
So how does this work? Lead me through the typical student, and understanding that there is no typical student, and you right. offer a lot of flexibility. If I decided to apply, say, hey, I want some theological training, what goes on?
Well, first thing, of course, is to ask what degree level. See, this is another thing that we do that most seminaries don't do, and that is that we offer undergraduate program. We have an associate's degree as well as a bachelor's degree. So that makes our student body even more across the board, because we have students who, you know, who are like a man might have been a pastor for 20 years but never got his bachelor's degree, and now it's time to go back and get that. So we have quite a bit. So the first thing is, you know, what degree level are you looking at, and what educational background do you have, and whether or not they can transfer into whatever it is that they want to do. Number one, that's the primary thing. And then, of course, there's an application process. We want to know their background. We want to know that they, you know, they have they agree with our statement of faith, which, by the way, is very basic. It doesn't have a lot of the peripheral issues. It's just a basic statement of faith of the basic fundamentals of the Christianity, because we have to have it just basic, because, as I said, we have people from various denominations on our faculty and right. students coming in. So we want to know that they're solidly Christian. And then once they've gone through the process and have applied and have been accepted, and not all students get accepted, as I said earlier, because sometimes they're trying to transfer in from schools that simply we don't recognize, then we ask them to write a learning contract. And a learning contract is simply a statement by them saying, this is who I am, this is my previous education, this is the degree for which I've enrolled in Columbia, here are my goals, and then a list of the classes that person has either selected or, working with somebody, has created. And then we, you know, put that together. The student signs off on the learning contract, the school signs off on the learning contract, and the person's professor has to sign off on the learning contract. once that's all done, then they're up and running, and they work with their professor through the program.
Which is, and we'll put links up to this, because on your website you have examples of typical or common types of learning contracts, mm-hmm. and what you expect from that. So people who want to see that, and also the statement of faith that they that students have to make, that's also up there as well. Mm-hmm. Let me ask about who your student body is. You work with the students, you get a sense of who these folks are. You know, you don't see them face to face, but you learn something from when they apply. Who's applying to your program? Are these, you know, 19, 20-year-olds like yourself who just didn't like school and want to try something different? Is it older pastors that want a little bit more training? Who do you get?
Yeah, it's typically not the younger people. In fact, we had a few early on kids right out of high school decide that they wanted to do programs with us. And, you know, in the first few years, we didn't realize the difficulty with that. And the difficulty was basically is that a person must be really terribly self-motivated to pull this off.
Yes.
And most kids right out of high school are simply not.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when they go to college, they're, you know, sitting in class, they're still quite often not ready for that. And so we had several students who enrolled young people right out of high school, or even 19 or 20 years old, excuse me, and they just simply failed. And there was a couple of them that we just felt so bad for them. We refunded all their money, even though they were past the point of refund, and said, look, you need to go find a college campus where you can live there and intermingle with other students and have, you know, professors in class and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I have to stop you right there, because as somebody who does teach an online course, one of the things that I have found is that many students think that a distance learning or online course is going to be all pajamas and fuzzy bunny slippers pretty easy. But you're right. It takes an enormous amount of self-discipline,
right,
to say, okay, you know, this week I have to get through this amount of pages. I have to write this assignment, et cetera, et cetera. And
right.
it's so easy when there's not somebody in the front of a classroom every other day provoking you to, you know, finish that assignment. It becomes enormously difficult to do that. And I that's one of the challenges that many people don't recognize with online learning. Yes, it does lower the cost for some people to do it, but it really puts a burden on their shoulders that says, you know, this is a lot of you. This is more you than you think it's going to be.
Well, absolutely. And here's part of the problem for students coming into those programs is that they've been spoon-fed through the public education system, and even if they've gone to college, they've been spoon-fed the information in classes like that. I mean, the bell rings 9:30, they have to go in class. If they don't, they get marked out. So when they move into a program like ours, it's new. It's like, my goodness, I have to do this on my own. I have to really work at this. And one of the things that we try to do is establish this with our students. We're not going to babysit you. Your professor will not, you know, email you every 2 weeks and say, how are you doing on that paper? You must get it done and get it to him or her. So when students need that kind of oversight, we often tell them, you know, go off to a college campus, because that's not what we provide. We provide a way by which you can do research and gain education, but we're not going to hold your hand, you know, not in that fashion anyway.
Right. Right, that can be a huge challenge, as I have found out with many of my students. What becomes of your students? What after they go through this program, and there's an undergraduate program, there's masters and doctorate programs that you have, so they're going to be of varying points in time. But what do some people do with your degrees?
Well, some go on for others, more education. We had one fellow who years ago contacted us and said, "Look, my whole life, all I've wanted was an accredited doctor of ministry degree, but I can't afford it." Because at that time he had a bachelor's degree, which meant now he has to do a master of divinity, and the master of divinity in every place that he checked was going to be $40,000-$50,000, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And he would have to take his family and move and all that sort of thing. He said, is there any possibility that I can do a master's degree with you guys and then transfer elsewhere for an accredited doctorate? Well, he did that, and he was able to do a master of divinity with us for a fraction of the cost that it would have cost anywhere else. And then he transferred from here to Luther Rice University for the Doctor of Ministry, and then completed his Doctor of Ministry. So, you know, his grand desire was fulfilled at a fraction of the cost. And we've had other students do that same thing as well. One fellow, he said he wanted a bachelor's degree from an accredited school. So what he did was 3 years with us at the undergraduate level, and then transferred those 3 years to a four-year program, and was able to get his bachelor's degree from that school. So, and then we've had a couple others do the same thing with PhDs. They did a master's degree with us and then transferred to accredited PhDs. So we have that. We do have students who transfer elsewhere. That's one thing. And then, of course, most of the students are probably already engaged in ministry, so they continue on in their ministry, whether they're pastoring or on the missions field or whatever. I'm not so sure, because we do, I just realized I didn't quite finish earlier, which it kind of flows into this, is that we don't have a lot of younger people. We have a lot of older 30s, 40s, 50s, and even more people doing our programs. So they're already in active ministry of some sort. And basically what they're trying to do is they want to do this for personal gain and personal desire or personal fun. So a lot of them are not using the degree to open doors. Those doors are already open to them, but they want to fulfill lifelong dreams and that sort of thing. But we have people who have gone on to publish books, write books. One of the things that we try to do here is that we try to make students aware of writing much more than they've ever seen before. We've had students transfer in from traditional accredited seminaries with master's degrees, and even with doctorate degrees. They're doing a second doctorate or a master's degree, and they're doing their first doctorate, and they find out through our program, gee, I'm not a very good writer at all. I thought I was. And some of them have gone on to write books, and, of course, we have people who have started their own parachurch ministries, a lot in the apologetics fields, and that sort of thing. And, you know, so a lot of them are already in ministry, and some of them are in some aspect of ministry, and they're going forward with their own personal ministry programs.
That's very cool. And again, I think the self-discipline that one needs to get through one of these programs really does encourage that entrepreneurial, I'm going to write my own book, or I'm going to, you know, start up my own parachurch organization.
I think you're right. Yeah. The mere fact that they have to put in that type of self-motivation to complete the degree program changes them. That, while it's not part of the academic list of things, that is part of the academia that happens. Number one is they become self-sufficient. They're not just spoon-fed. They learn how to research for themselves, because they're not being told by a professor every week or every day of the week, you know, what to think. So they become a researcher. They become self-motivated. They learn how to write well, because in the communication through our program, there aren't tests. There's no essay exam. There are papers. Students produce, when at the end of a class, they have to produce a well-written research document. And if it's not well-written, and so many schools, even at the seminary and doctoral levels I've seen, they're more concerned about grading students on content, and that's it. Well, we grade students on content and presentation. So they become, a lot of them become very good writers as well. And then, as you said, once they've gone through that program and then they have a desire to start a ministry or whatever, or write a book, they've got that self-motivation and ability.
Yeah. Let me ask this too, just about the logistics. Your seminary is about 20 years old now, 2 decades. And over that course of 2 decades, and my students are surprised to find this out, that a lot of things have changed, especially with the interwebs, that back in the early 1990s, way back then, the internet really wasn't that big of a thing.
It wasn't, right?
But now it's the thing, and we're seeing this at University of Washington and other places that are talking about these massive online open classes, or MOOCs as they call them. How has the internet changed the way you go about your seminary business or delivering the education that you do?
Well, when we started there, as you said, really the internet was not there, and we didn't have a website. We just had a presence where if somebody was interested, we would send them a catalog. That was their touchstone to the school, was a catalog. Now, we actually did have people on occasion fly out and meet us and shake hands and talk and go out to coffee, so they'd have some sense of that sort of thing. But typically, what they knew about the school is what they saw in the catalog. Was it a slick catalog? How well written was it? What's laid out? That was their contact. And, of course, everything was correspondence by mail and telephone calls, lots of telephone calls. But then as the Internet came into function with us, one of the things that ultimately transpired is we quit making catalogs entirely. Obviously, for years we had overlaps, because not everybody, even though we finally had a website and we had an email, that didn't mean everybody else out there did.
Right.
And so we would be fielding questions and information from students through the Internet, and then, of course, predominantly we'd still be dealing with the correspondence method, not just method of introduction to the school, but also classes. It was all done via mail.
Yeah.
And we'd snail mail it out, they'd snail mail it back, and that sort of thing. And it was, you know, of course, now I think about it, and I think, wow, that was really arduous. But back then, nobody thought that because we didn't have anything to compare it to.
Right.
That was just the way it was.
Yeah.
And so as we progressed with the Internet, and as more and more people, you know, got online, the physical mail started dropping off. The physical phone calls started dropping off. And we started giving our presence known rather than as a hard copy catalog was our website. And then students wanted to start doing their programs. I remember the first couple times students said, well, can I just submit a paper by email? Well, no, you can't. You have to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to mail it to us. And part of the problem was, at that time, when students wrote something and sent something by email, how do you judge the formatting? Because it was all messed up. You know,
yeah.
And then, of course, now then there's word processing and all that started in Microsoft Word and Macintosh, whatever. And so it became a viable alternative to mail was to actually submit as an attached document. But all that was new.
Mm-hmm.
And so then pretty soon we got to the point where we would tell students, okay, don't mail it to us. Do this, you know, buy this and put, you know, use this application. And then it just slowly shifted over to where now when we get letters in the mail, when somebody says, look, I don't have a computer, but this is what I would like to do, we say sorry. I don't know that there's many correspondence schools left out there. And so we just simply don't want to do that because it is so very time-consuming, and we typically don't accept students when they want to do it simply by mail.
So here's one other aspect. You know, is that, you know, in the early days, some folks would actually fly out, shake hands, and
mm-hmm.
take a look around, sniff around, you know, who you guys are.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a graduation ceremony? I mean, it's... it would seem like that would be kind of a cool thing to do is that, yes, people are in far-flung places, but it would be kind of nice to, you know, occasionally meet these people face-to-face and to shake hands and to have a cup of coffee.
Right. Actually, we do. And here's the thing. Years ago, when we first started, we actually did require time on campus. And we would have students come, and we would do a seminar. So we have a graduation/seminar weekend. And so students would come to either graduate or to come to to a seminar. And then they would be able to see the graduation as well, those who weren't graduating. And then but what we found, though, is that the reason why we were doing the on-campus part was simply because that's the way everybody does it. And we started asking ourselves, why are we demanding students to spend all that money to fly out here from Timbuktu or just from the other side of the U.S. to do a class that they could just as easily do by correspondence? And we began to realize it was simply because, as I said, that's the way everybody does it. We should do it that way. And it really wasn't a very good reason. So we stopped with the seminars. And in stopping with the seminars that were required, we also began to realize, we continued with the graduation, we began to realize we had fewer and fewer people coming to the program for the graduation ceremony because half of or more of the students that were coming because of the seminars, not because of graduation. And we had one graduation one year where I think three people were there. And I thought, okay, we spent a lot of money putting this together at the local Red Lion. We're not doing this next year. So we decided every 3 years we would have a graduation. And then later we actually decided every 5 years. So now that's what we do now. Every 5 years we have a graduation. And anybody that's graduated at any time in the past may come to the graduation. And people do come for quite a way sometimes. And I'm just thinking if we've ever had anybody come from outside the country. I don't think we have. I think the farthest away was probably Florida. But yeah, so we do have a graduation every 5 years, and that also allows us some time because our school body is small. After you have 5 years worth of graduates, you might have a few people actually show up rather than, if you know, maybe two or three people might graduate in any given year in some years, and therefore, you know, and then they might not all want to show up. So
that is a neat thing too. And I know of the Red Lion that you speak because that's when we go hiking at Mount St. Helens occasionally. That's the one we stop at, and it has a great make-it-yourself pancake maker, which is is always a draw for a hotel for me.
Yeah, there you go.
And we just had a little technical glitch there. The handheld battery was going dead on Rick's phone, so we moved over to the speakerphone. And I just wanted to finish up here with some of your thoughts on the utility of a theological education. And I think I might be wading into a little bit of controversy here. I'll start out by noting that I do understand the basic importance of seminary training, that if you're going to be a pastor, a minister, or even a counselor in a parachurch organization, that you need to know what's in the Bible. And obviously, it's going to be very useful to have somebody help you understand what the difficult stuff is to understand. So, and that's all well and good. However, it also seems to me that there's a danger with seminaries of over-intellectualizing the message of the scriptures, and or becoming very narrowly specialized just on one book of, let's say, the Old Testament, and or even a subsection of a book. I mean, I've seen theologians who specialize their entire career with one small section of the book of Job or something like that, and it can become very easy to lose the big picture and also to lose contact with the people that you eventually want to minister to. Within my field, the sociology of religion, scholars have noted that a lot of schismatic movements are often rebellions against clergy who have become very distant from their flock because they spent most of their time in these faculty lounges in seminaries, and they don't resonate with common folks. And, and that, you know, what's more ironic here is that after a generation or two, many of these breakaway groups or movements establish their own seminaries, then they become highly professionalized and intellectualized again, and the cycle moves on, they become rebelled against. And thinking about the Puritans in early American history and how the Methodists rose up and challenged them in the First Great Awakening, and then the Methodists get seminaries, and then people are rising up in the fundamentalist movement and Pentecost movement over a couple decades then. Is there a danger in theological training of becoming too intellectualized or too professionalized and losing touch with the common folks, the folks out there in the pews? And if you think that's the case, how do you guys deal with that in your seminary training?
Well, I certainly do think that's the case, and you've nailed it. That does happen. Thankfully, it doesn't happen all the time, and I don't know what the percentage would be. That would be an interesting study to find out, you know, how often this does occur. But I've met some seminary grads that, I don't know if it's pride of intellect or what, but just, I can't even imagine them ministering to an actual church group of people who get up and have real jobs and go to work every day and then try to come into church on Sunday and try to be fed by such lofty terminology and discussions. It just blows me away that does happen. But one of the benefits, as I mentioned earlier, about our school is that typically we have people who are already in some aspect of ministry. So we're not so much training them to get there. They're wanting to fulfill a lifelong goal. They're already in ministry. They're already functioning. So now what we're doing is coming alongside them and building up a certain area of thought for them. Whether, you know, I've had people who are pastors, for instance, who had pretty good backgrounds in theology, and they would call and say, look, you know, I'm really understanding now that I need to add apologetics to my overall thought process so that I can help people in the community besides just those in my church. And so even that for them is something geared toward reaching the lost. So quite often in our situation, we rarely run into somebody that's doing it for purely intellectual reasons, although we have. Mm-hmm. And we have had some that say, well, look, I really want to do this just on a theoretical basis because this is what I love to study. Well, you can. You can do that if that's what you choose to do, because students here design their own programs. So for us, though, the majority of those students are already in some fashion of active ministry, functioning well with the people they're working with. And so I don't think that what we do with them overshadows that. But that certainly does happen, as I said. And one of the things that Walter Martin, I don't know if you're familiar with his name, Walter Martin was the original Bible answer man. And he used to say on occasion that his mentor, Donald Gray Barnhouse, had a phrase that once Martin said it, I just loved it and I thought it was great. Donald Gray Barnhouse used to say, you have to take the hay out of the haylofts and put it down on the ground where the cows can eat it. And it's just that simple, and that's one of the things that we try to encourage all of our student body and faculty to know, is that, look, while some of this is very lofty and some of the terminology is very heady, you have to realize that you cannot bring that into the regular pastorate. And so we had one faculty member, in fact, that was really interesting, taking a fellow through a Master of Divinity program, and one of the things that he would require his students to do is not only write an academic paper, but to write a paper that he, the professor could then hand to his 12-year-old daughter, and if she couldn't understand it, the student didn't pass.
Yeah.
And so that was very interesting, and so he had to bring that down to a 12-year-old mindset. Now, not every faculty member does that, but that was an interesting one, and one of the things that the student said is that that was the hardest part, was writing the paper for the 12-year-old rather than the academic paper.
Yeah, I smile as you're saying that, because one of the things that I do with my graduate students is put them through what I call the anti-Maryland test. And my anti-Maryland was a typical person. She worked as a high school secretary, smart person, but not familiar with all the academic jargon. Mm-hmm. And it was important for me to, when I was going through graduate school, to be able to explain to my Aunt Marilyn, who was interested in what I was doing, what I was actually doing, and do it without the jargon. You know, understanding that she's a very smart person, but oftentimes we use a language that is so esoteric that we remove ourselves from those individuals. So,
right. And that is, you know, obviously that happens, and it's sad that it does. In the situation, the church I'm now attending, years ago, prior to my arrival, the pastor told me that they had a new guy just out of seminary with a Master of Divinity come in as a youth pastor, and all he wanted to do was talk in such ways that the kids simply couldn't understand him, and it obviously didn't work, and they had to let him go. Yeah. But that just happens all too often. I wonder, however, is when people graduate with their degrees, whether it's a Master of Divinity, a PhD, or whatever, if it's they're still in that mode, or maybe in that pride, and then as time goes on, they begin to kind of back away from it, because I've actually seen that happen as well, where fresh graduates are showing off, but after two or three years, they become more real with the people that they're functioning with.
And that is one of the things that we're trying to do with this podcast here, and it's very heartening to hear that that is what you're doing with Columbia Evangelical Seminary, is that we know we have an audience out there that is very interested in this stuff, that is very smart, and we just want to basically take what we're learning, what we know, what we understand about the scripture and sociology and all that stuff, and bring that to the folks that are out there. So with that said, I think we'll end up and conclude here, and I want to thank Rick for being on the show, and for all those folks who are interested in the Columbia Evangelical Seminary, stop by our website and we'll provide links to that there. So thank you again, Rick.
Thank you, Tony. God bless.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.